Morning, everyone. I'd like to call the Legacy Committee meeting to order. We're going to hold off on the minutes. We noticed we had a typo, so we'll bring those back next meeting. So today we have an opportunity to have the Clean Water folks come. I think Mr. Gardner's here. Come on up, please. As some of you know, and you're soon going to find out even more, but 33% of our funds go to the clean water effort for Minnesota, and the Clean Water Council has they work hard on ideas and have a process that they've been doing and some of the work, and they're going to tell us what they've been working on in the past and how we're we're not really going to cover your budget, I don't think, coming up, are we? Or
a little bit.
Okay.
Not a line by line, Mr. Chair, but
just to warn you, Mr. Gardner used to be a representative, so he got smart and left us. No,
I was liberated by the voters, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Mr. Gardner.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I should remind people that former legislators are a dime a dozen, so I appreciate the recognition. So. Mr. Chair, I also tried to pack the house for you today. I've got my peeps here, my clean water peeps. But there is another hearing on soil and water conservation districts and another meeting downstairs, so we probably lost a little bit of the draw there. Mr. Chair, I'm Paul Gardner. I'm the administrator for the Clean Water Council. I was asked today if I could give you a flavor of how we use the Clean Water Fund, which is one-third of the revenue from the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment. Constructive bit of feedback that the chair and others gave me when I took the job 4 years ago is that we didn't really give people an idea of how all the pieces fit together. We would give you the line-by-line spreadsheet stuff on the particular programs, but we didn't show people how they fit together. So today is an effort to show the broad strategy, and since there are so many new members to Legacy, Mr. Chair, I thought I would do that broad overview, and just to show you that I'm pandering to my audience, I do have a few slides about how we deploy the Clean Water Fund in the Twin Cities Metro. So, well, let's get rolling, and Mr. Chair, I know that you will interrupt me if people have questions, or there will be a few spots when I'll pause to see if people want to take a breather and ask questions. So first, the Minnesota Clean Water Council is a state advisory council created in 2006 as part of the Clean Water Legacy Act. The Clean Water Legacy Act is legislation that governs how we detect and address impairments in our water, protect our groundwater from degradation, and protect drinking water sources. In 2009, after the ratification of the amendment in 2008, the legislature gave the Clean Water Council the added task of recommending how to use the Clean Water Fund. The Clean Water Council itself has 28 members. 17 of them can vote on recommendations, and they are by state statute in the constituencies that you see listed on the right of the slide. So we have a very diverse group from local government, non-governmental organizations, business, and the like. We also are represented by non-voting members, including six state agencies that are represented over here, and the University of Minnesota, and also four legislators, one from each party and one from each body. We actually just got the word that Representative Purcell will join us as the House DFL member on the Clean Water Council, which is great news. She's very familiar with us. And then, of course, Representative Heintzman is our GOP House member, Senator McEwen from Senate DFL and the Senate GOP slot is currently open after the retirement of Senator Rood. The Clean Water Fund, as I'm sure you know, is one-third of the revenue from the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment. Mr. Chair, I have noticed since that you and I voted to put the amendment on the ballot in 2008 that a new generation of Minnesotans has come around that may not actually know some of the backstory of how it came to be, that it was put on the ballot in 2008, and that it actually expires. I have run into many people who just assume that it runs indefinitely. So I just thought it'd be helpful and let anyone know who's watching that it's amendment expires on midnight, June 30th, 2034, which is 11 years, 4 months, 29 days, 13 hours, and 30 minutes from 10:30 this morning.
Who's calling?
I was just going to use that joke, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Backer. I'm a little slow. By the time the amendment expires after 25 years, it's likely that about $3 billion will have been appropriated. The amendment is very specific about how must be used to protect and enhance and restore our surface waters, and to protect our groundwater from degradation and to protect drinking water sources. And at least 5%, according to the Constitution, of the Clean Water Fund must be spent only to protect drinking water sources. I'm pleased to say that even the most rudimentary back-of-envelope math shows that we exceed that 5% number by a lot. There are also, we also voted for this, Mr. Chair, in 2009 to be more specific in the permitted uses of the Clean Water Fund. I won't read it all off, but there are some things we are required to do, such as when we find impaired waters, we have to come up with a total maximum daily load report, or TMDL, which tells you what the diet of a particular body of water must be to meet water quality standards. But all sorts of other good stuff here, too. I'm pandering to you on some of these slides, but I'll pander to my peeps here and just mention that we have seven agencies at the state of Minnesota and the University of Minnesota that administer the money from the Clean Water Fund. They are the recipients of the dollars in the legacy bill when you get it. However, about two-thirds of the money received by those agencies leaves the state and goes directly to landowners, local governments, and provides technical assistance. And yes, we do support full-time employees of the state with the Clean Water Fund, but more than half of those employees actually are in Greater Minnesota, where they're more likely to directly interact with the public and local governments. So, Mr. Chair, when I started, four years ago, I gave you a big three-ring binder of all the studies and things that had been done in your district to try and illustrate how we use the money, and I think that went over like a lead balloon, probably, just because it's a lot of paper. And so I've learned to describe how we spend the Clean Water Fund in 30 seconds and then see what happens. And I've noticed with the general public and legislators that this is very handy. So the approach, or boy, that didn't come out right. Sorry, Mr. Chair. Well, you're regular people. You represent the people. So in Minnesota, we use the Clean Water Fund this way. We test waters to see if there's anything wrong with it first. And if there is something wrong with it, we want to find the source of the problem. When we find the source of the problem, we want to come up with a plan to fix the water. And then we fund the fix, and then we measure to see if the fix worked. That's our basic approach. I have in parentheses the names of particular types of strategies that we use in our government lingo. The thing is that while that took 20 or 30 seconds, it takes a decade or more for that process to happen. We have the generosity of the voters to thank for the money that we have, but we're able to examine waters in every corner of the state. We have 80 major watersheds, as depicted in the map on the upper left. So we can do things on a scale that other states cannot do. But in order to do things on a comprehensive scale, it takes some time. So I'll illustrate. Here's a map of the Yellow Medicine River watershed in southwestern Minnesota. You can see the Minnesota River running from northwest to southeast, and the Yellow Medicine River flows into the Minnesota. It's a heavy agricultural region. Roughly a quarter to a half of the acreage there has drain tile in it, so the water has been sped up in order to have productive agriculture. In 2010, after the passage of the Clean Water, the Legacy Amendment, money flowed to be able to do that testing. So an intensive watershed monitoring program. I would, as an analogy, maybe say it's a little bit like doing a comprehensive physical at the Mayo Clinic as opposed to going to your doctor and getting some vital signs taken. It's very comprehensive. It takes a couple of years to assemble all the information. But after 3 years, the PCA put out the report that shows that there are 132 impairments in the waters in this watershed. You can see the types of impairments on the right. It's everything from things that you would expect in an agricultural area to things like PCBs and mercury, which are often the result of airborne sources that we can't really do anything about. So it's pretty typical for an area in that part of the state. The dots are lakes, and obviously the lines are streams. Within a few years after that, the Pollution Control Agency puts together a set of strategies that show all the things based on the science that has to be done to get these waters to water quality standards so we can get them off the impaired waters list. We call that a WRAPS, or a Watershed Restoration and Protection Strategy. That to-do list is then used by local stakeholders and the state to determine which of those things they can prioritize with clean water funds. The result is this usually incomprehensible table. This is from another watershed, but we have these tables that summarize all the science. And in this case, it says if we do the certain number of best management practices in this watershed by a certain date, we should get the desired pollutant reductions that get us the water quality standards and have an idea of what the cost will be. Other states do not have this. We will soon have an idea of the price tag in every watershed in the state. That's the good news. The bad news is we know that the price tag far exceeds the money available from the Clean Water Fund. So we have to prioritize, and that usually follows to areas that protect drinking water sources or local recreational assets, usually. So the plan for the Yellow Medicine watershed indicated that we should prioritize certain parts of the watershed, and in this case you can see how Clean Water Fund grants were used in these little green triangles. That's where activities were undertaken by the local watershed, usually with farmers, to employ best management practices upstream. And so that was all out of a grant based on what was in the comprehensive plans. You don't have to wait for a plan to start fixing water. There are a lot of blue dots on here which represent a Clean Water Fund activities that took place after the ratification of the amendment. You can see the types of activities on the right. My favorite are water and sediment control basins, or WASCOBs. If you have a rain garden in your front yard or your neighborhood here in town, it operates in a very similar idea. You get the water out of the place you don't want it, like a field or my basement. Put it in a place that's still on the property and allow water to meter out more slowly so you reduce the chance of erosion. The reason I mention all the times here is that there has been some intensive monitoring just in the last year or so to see if these fixes worked. And then we'll be able to see if some of those waters can come off the impaired waters list. The reason I mention the timeline is we started in 2010. It might be 2023, 24, even 25 before we know some of these waters can come off the list. That's why the 25-year period of the legacy amendment is so important for the Clean Water Fund. We have the predictability to do this structural, comprehensive approach. More pictures. So hopefully this picture will say 1,000 words. This is the approach we use for drinking water. It applies a similar logic that we use for surface waters. This is a satellite photo of Verndale in Wadena County, which has nitrate levels that are too high in its wells. You see US 10 bisecting the town from northwest to southeast, and along Highway 10 there are two wellheads that provide the water supply for this town. In the blue, you can see a wellhead protection area. This tells you that groundwater is moving from southwest to northeast. So anything that could contaminate on the land and make its way into the groundwater in that blue area is stuff we're concerned about, because it could make its way into the well within a short period of time. The problem is that the blue area goes beyond the municipal boundary, which is the gold line, and so a municipality has less power to regulate its drinking water supply outside its city boundaries. So using the Clean Water Fund, the health department is able to work with this municipality to create what's called a DWISMA. We often do not have very flashy acronyms in state government, but I'd say this one is really good, the DWISMA. The Drinking Water Supply Management Area. This is a delineation of the area that you want to protect to avoid having contaminants come in the well within the next 10 years. That DWISMA goes beyond the municipal boundaries. In this case, as it surrounds some farmland outside Verndale, the health department then can work with, no problem, the health department can work with the municipality as well as the Department of Agriculture, the Board of Water and Soil Resources to figure out what to do. We also have some regulation that kicks in here, the groundwater protection rule, which is worth a whole nother presentation, but it, there's a series of stages that this water supplier can use to get safer water and to get nitrates down. The first is voluntary, which involves agencies working with landowners to figure out which of the tools in our toolbox that we can use to help reduce nitrogen in the groundwater. Everything from land exchanges to easements to intensive nitrogen management to having perennial grains developed at the University of Minnesota through the Forever Green program to try and fix that nitrogen. So we have a lot of tools, and if none of those work or if a landowner isn't interested, within a few years regulation could kick in. But the Clean Water Fund helps fund all of those activities. On the planning side, the Department of Health also puts together a drinking water supply management plan or a protection plan. Sorry, I'm getting all my alphabet stuff mixed up. But they work with the municipality to come up again with a to-do list of everything you need to do for that water supply to get to safe drinking water standards. And then, unlike a lot of plans in other states which stay on the shelf, we actually have the money with the Clean Water Fund to fund what's in the plan. The Clean Water Fund can fund about half the things in those plans. It's everything from removing old, abandoned fuel tanks to generators for small towns that, if there's a power outage, can keep the water disinfection system going so that they don't have a boil water order. There's a whole range of activities that fit for small grants under $10,000. So the Clean Water Fund touches all of the activities to help protect that drinking water supply. And then I'm just going to pause for a second and see if anyone wants to blurt out questions, comments, gripes, throw tomatoes, whatever.
Any questions for members at
this point? That sounds good.
Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Chair. Director, thanks for coming in. And I'm going to ask a question to which I think I already know the answer. But so far, we've had a very nice presentation. I appreciate the levity and the seriousness at the same time. And one of the things you just mentioned briefly in this discussion about a DWISMA is looking forward 10 years. We're trying to figure out at Clean Water Council what contaminants we might be tracking more aggressively and try to be proactive in that effort. If anyone in the room cares to do a Google search of solar panels and PFAS, you'll be shocked to see screen page after page after page working on that issue and studies across the entire country finding that we're seeing an amount, whether it's hazardous or not, we probably need to do more work, but an amount of PFAS in the soil around these solar farms. And I just was going to quickly check and see if the Clean Water Council is looking at funding any research of our own to confirm, considering we're also working on legislation currently that would have a huge impact potentially on this, and of course that being passed this last week. Is there something there that Minnesotans can be confident is in the works so we're not creating another problem with more PFAS on the landscape?
Director Gardner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Heitzman, actually I have not been tracking on that issue, but I have solar in my house, so I'm interested to do some Googling. I think what you're saying is that there may be PFAS used in the production of panels. Is that?
Thank you, Chair. Coatings. The coatings are unfortunately, it appears to be, at least in the many, many, many studies and stories that I'm reading, leaving some PFAS on the landscape. To what extent is still being discovered? So I was wanting to bring that up today.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Heinzman, I would be more than happy to bring that up to the council. We actually do have three programs where we're infusing new dollars into PFAS monitoring and health assessment. So I definitely can add that to the list. I appreciate the input.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Chair. That's all.
Representative Farr.
Yeah, Director Gardner. So quick question. How many FTEs in the department?
Mr. Chair, well, when it comes to the Clean Water Council, there's just two of us, but in terms of state employee FTEs that are funded by the Clean Water Fund, it's, I think it's a number under 200, or under 300, excuse me.
300, okay.
Representative Farr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then one more. So two-thirds of those funds are going outside of state government. So how's that tracked? How are those, I mean, those FTEs still tracking those dollars, ensuring they're going to where we want them to go? Can you walk me through that?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, all of the agencies do things like make grants or provide technical assistance to local units of government. Sometimes the technical assistance is provided by state employees. Sometimes they're done by local government employees. The one thing that I have appreciated from afar, it does look like we have a lot of layers, you know, a lot of entities, but I have found that those entities work really well together, and so they try and size up a problem and figure out who the right people are. We did a field tour to southwestern Minnesota, to Rock, Nobles, and Pipestone counties a year and a half ago, and we listened to the SWCD talk about how they worked with regional staff in the Department of Health, from the Board of Water and Soil Resources, from the PCA, and the DNR to help resolve a problem with their water supply. So, you know, depending on the situation, we find the right people with the right skills to do the job. It doesn't matter whether they're with the state or with the local unit of government.
Representative Farr.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Lilly. My question to the Clean Water Council is, what's your involvement in East Metro in regards to, you know, the MPC and DNR in terms of, you know, clean water for East Metro?
Director Gardner.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative Chai, I do have some Metro-based information, but your question is specific. So there are two things specifically. So from the area from White Bear Lake into the East Metro where the PFAS is an issue, the DNR does have a groundwater management area that's designated, which allows them to, you know, step up the communication and liaising with local communities to bring resources to bear and looking at an issue. So that includes modeling with the depletion of White Bear Lake to understanding groundwater flow with PFAS. So the Clean Water Fund funds the DNR for their groundwater management area work, and we are also in the upcoming recommendations that you will soon get, be funding additional ongoing monitoring for PFAS in Minnesota for rivers, lakes, and also with groundwater. So there is this broader PFAS blueprint that the Pollution Control Agency led with in concert with other agencies. There are dozens of activities listed in there, and the Clean Water Council identified areas where the Clean Water Fund was the most appropriate source of funding, and so we have the ongoing monitoring instead of ad hoc monitoring. We will now include PFAS as part of the whole regime for the rest of the 25-year amendment. There is the DNR is now going to be monitoring fish for PFAS instead of just two other contaminants. And then the Department of Health now we're asking for more money for capacity to develop health-based guidance for various contaminants, but PFAS is causing quite a backlog, so that's why we want to have more capacity to evaluate PFAS.
Representative Chuck.
Good, thank you.
Director Gardner, go ahead.
Very good.
Keep moving.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is a perception that because of the way we present the Clean Water Fund that almost all the money goes to Greater Minnesota, and while there is a lot of important work going on in Greater Minnesota everywhere, we actually have significant dollars that go in the Twin Cities Metro, and we've never really showed that concentration of effort in the Metro, so I thought I would do it because I'm reading the room, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to show you four high-visibility projects that have been funded by the Clean Water Fund in the Metro. We have a lot of watershed districts in the Metro that have levying authority. So they have dollars that they can access that others can't. Yes, sir.
To that point, do you actually have a percentage? Because Lasard-Sams actually provides like a percentage. Do you actually have a percentage?
Mr. Chair, we never know before the recommendations are made because so many dollars that are given out are for competitive grants. So yeah, we don't know who's going to apply. But the rule of thumb I've heard is, you know, roughly 70% Greater Minnesota, 30 Metro. But if you desire a more precise figure, I'd that would be worth looking at.
I think we do, but that sounds maybe a little better than Lessard numbers. But
very good. And I think probably perhaps I'm thinking of the backstory of the amendment. I think that was a concern in the metro among voters and lawmakers that at least the habitat part would be heavily concentrated outside the metro. So correct. We in the metro said, what's in it for us? And so we have a much more multifaceted set of funding buckets.
Go ahead, Director.
So I just wanted to show you an example of some projects that have Clean Water Fund involvement that are just a stone's throw away from this building. One very exciting one is the Trout Brook Nature Sanctuary, which is located just west of 35E and south of Maryland Avenue. You can see downtown St. Paul in the background in the big picture. This is a ravine that used to have a stream that drained from McCarran's Lake to the Mississippi River. It was filled in roughly a century ago to make a railroad freight yard, and so the stream was put into a culvert underground. Since that time, that site has been daylighted, as we call it, and now the stream runs above ground again, and it's been turned into a recreational asset. I talked to one of your Senate colleagues who said that he bikes there regularly and didn't know that that project was funded by the Clean Water Fund. For any of you soccer fans, we have the Allianz Field that has a stormwater reuse system. So all the stormwater, all the rain that falls on that stadium drains into tanks that you see in black that are now underground, and then there's a disinfection and treatment system to actually use that water for irrigation on the site. So that water does not go straight to the Mississippi River. The third item here, and all three of these are carried out by the Capital Region Watershed District, is Como Lake, an iconic lake here in the metro. The Clean Water Fund was used to help treat stormwater that was coming from about 400 acres surrounding the lake, mostly from the public golf course. That water now goes into retention ponds and can infiltrate rather than go straight to the lake. So Como Lake is really close to meeting its water quality standard for phosphorus. Not quite there yet, but this is just one part of the puzzle. And then one somewhat counterintuitive example, Frogtown Farms, which is maybe a mile and a half from here. It's an urban farm helping serve their local community. They actually are certified by a program funded by the Clean Water Fund, the Agricultural Water Quality Certification Program. There's about just under 1 million acres certified in the state for farms that are doing extraordinary things to protect water quality. And it's being done right here in the metro with Frogtown Farms. But there are some metro-heavy activities, as I would call it, funded by the Clean Water Fund. The Met Council uses grants to reduce water demand here in the metro by 150 million gallons of groundwater per year. That's come in quite handy as we've seen stress on our water resources from dry weather recently. There actually have now been not just expenditures for suburbs that use a lot of water and irrigation systems, but we've now made grants here in St. Paul as well. There are a lot of wells, particularly here in Ramsey County, that have been sealed so that our aquifers are protected from abandoned drinking water wells. We do that in Greater Minnesota as well. Stormwater is a major pollutant source for impaired waters in the metro, so the Clean Water Fund has funded research like finding out that enhanced street sweeping is one of the cheapest ways to improve lake water quality in cities that have a lot of trees. We discovered that through research funded by the Clean Water Fund. We also help the PCA in its administration of a statewide stormwater permit. Most cities have to have a permit to show that they're reducing the amount of pollutants that are going into storm drains. It recently was changed to include a lot of chloride-related things with salt. And the nice thing about the Clean Water Fund is we can support staff who, in effect, answer the call when cities have a question to see how to comply. We have, I know this is a very serious issue of carp removal, but it's quite entertaining to see how researchers are finding ways to remove carp. I live in Shoreview, and Lake Owosso and Rice Creek have been test beds for figuring out how to remove carp that tend to churn up a lot of sediment and phosphorus. There are some old agricultural ditches that are in the metro area that took water off the fields, but now they're surrounded by suburban development, and so they're prime candidates to restore back into streams again. To slow water down and to create recreational assets. Representative Jordan has been carrying bills about lead service lines, and she has been showing a report that was put together by the University of Minnesota and the Health Department on what it would cost to remove lead service or lead in our water delivery systems in Minnesota. That was done at the behest of the Clean Water Council after the debacle in Flint, Michigan. And the Health Department really came through with a first-in-the-nation type of report that showed us that we get a two-for-one benefit for every dollar spent removing lead from our water delivery systems. And then finally, we have a big problem in the metro with excessive chloride that isn't actually melting snow and ice. It's bouncing off the roads and ending up in our lakes, rivers, and streams. We've got at least two dozen lakes that are close to biologically dead because there's too much salt in it. We have a nation-leading program, the Smart Salting Program, paid for by federal and clean water fund sources, to train snow removal professionals on how to use the right amount of salt at the right time. They've trained over 5,300 professionals from public works departments to private snow removal contractors to individuals. So some cities, including mine and the Mayo Clinic, have reduced their chloride use by something like 40%. And if the Mayo Clinic, which doesn't want to treat people who are slipping and falling, says that they can reduce their salt use, then that's pretty credible, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee have raised in committee and in meetings the question about how the Clean Water Fund intersects with equity objectives. The Clean Water Council over the last few years has had a lot of guest speakers to really delve into this issue. It crosses a lot of different questions from gender-based disparities in agriculture. There are a lot of women who own farmland in Minnesota. Some are farming, but many rent their land out, and trying to get renters to apply water quality techniques can be difficult when you have a non-operating landowner. We have place-based disparities where you live determines whether you have access to drinkable, fishable, and swimmable water. There are sometimes historical reasons why people had to live where they live, so that is a factor. There is also income-based disparity, where people may not be able to have clean water to drink because they can't afford a water treatment system or to drill a new well. So I wanted to give you a couple of examples where the Clean Water Fund is helping bridge the gap on those disparities. I'm finding that this is just scratching the surface. There are we keep finding things that we were already doing which actually help that we're just starting to catalog. But for example, a lot of rural communities have affordable water rates because the Clean Water Fund, as well as the Public Facilities Authority, are able to fund things that local ratepayers don't have to do. So I read headlines of rural communities around the rest of the country that have to pay exorbitant water rates to be able to fund basic infrastructure, and we're able to do it with state funding. We have a lot of communities that are under-sewered in Minnesota. These are sometimes just crossroads communities of a few dozen buildings that have outdated septic systems, sometimes a straight pipe system where you just flush and it goes out of pipe in the back. The Public Facilities Authority has used Clean Water Fund grants to work with these communities, and for a few tens of thousands of dollars gets a planning grant so they can start to figure out what a long-term solution may look like. And then that could lead to additional funding for federal or state capital investment money. So we have dozens of communities that are going to have cleaner water because of that funding. We have a $1 million appropriation in the current biennium that is for what we call water legacy partners. We're looking for people other than the usual suspects in local government who might be able to bring good ideas and get them in the pipeline for how we can get to cleaner water faster. Half of that money is set aside for tribal governments. The other half is for NGOs, for 501c3 nonprofits. That RFP is still open for another 2 weeks. So if anyone has any questions, please let me know. But we're looking for community organizations that generally haven't been thought of as our usual partners in getting clean water. We've also done a lot of coordination with tribes, not the council, but the PCA in particular, for monitoring water, especially in reservation lands in northern Minnesota. The agencies also participate in tribal consultation activities, according to the Waltz Flanagan administration's executive order on that topic. I just found out yesterday that in St. Paul, they received a Met Council grant from the Clean Water Fund for detecting leaks in the public water system and in replacing inefficient water fixtures like toilets in areas that the Census Bureau calls areas of concentrated poverty. I think we might use the phrase environmental justice here in Minnesota. But that's several hundred dollars to make sure that our infrastructure and the things that suburban households can get are available to people in the city of St. Paul. In rural areas, we also have low-income grants for property owners who can't afford to replace their septic system. Counties to date get up to $40,000 per cycle if they want to use it to provide those. That usually funds 2, 3, 4 septic systems per county. Not all counties participate, but we've seen close to 1,000 septic systems replaced over the last 10 years because of that program. And then finally, Mr. Chair, this is a new thing in the recommendations for the upcoming cycle. The health department will provide free well testing for private well owners for 10% of the state each year for the next 10 years. That's based on some pilot programs that were done in western and southeastern Minnesota. That was also paired with some mitigation assistance for low-income households. That's not part of the expansion yet. But we found a model that seems to work, and so we would like those households, whatever their income level, to be able to test for 5 major contaminants. One of them is lead, so that they know what they need to do to get to safe drinking water standards for their private wells. Mr. Chair, I'm going to pause, and I have some just frillier slides that I can dispense with if time is a factor.
Representative Finke, go ahead with your question, please.
Thank you so much for your presentation. Thank you, Chair Lilly. I just have a question about some of these equity-based programs that you're talking about. Can you talk a little bit about the need for them? Like, we offer them, but how much use are those programs getting? How much work is actually being produced by them in your work?
Director Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Finke. We're almost neighbors, too. We should chat. We haven't met yet. You know, the demand on the septic system example, as an example, we could probably double the amount of money we're using for septic systems just to inspect. We increase the inspection of septic systems. That's most of the money. We give the money to counties. But the low-income part is a fraction of that. We're actually asking for an increase in that because of unmet need. There is more demand for that program than we've had dollars, so we're looking to put in more dollars. Many of these programs are also competitive grants, so, you know, people apply. It's not necessarily a backlog system. In many cases, like under-sewered communities, the Public Facilities Authority has one of the best prioritization methods in state government for, you know, assigning points for communities to figure out who's ready for a particular upgrade. So if you're on the Capital Investment Committee, you'll probably see those long lists of cities that are looking to upgrade things. And if you're above the dotted line, you're likely to get it with the funding available. And if you're not, you have to wait, and it's based on a point system. Something very similar to that is done with things like the unsewered communities. But we haven't had as much demand for that program in recent years. It was front-loaded in the early days of the Clean Water Fund, and we've checked off a lot of boxes. But there still is a need to address those unsewered communities. There's a couple of areas where we're hoping some of those competitive grant proposals might address things where we haven't even thought of something. I have kind of a pet peeve on the issue of women owning land. I come from a long line of strong, persevering women who don't take any guff. And I've run into the University of Minnesota and some nonprofit organizations that are creating things called learning circles for women who own land. Maybe they're widowed, maybe they've inherited the land from their parents, but they live in St. Paul or California or New York, and they might want to do something with the land to make it more water quality friendly, but they may not know how, and they have to work with a renter who may be local, who may do things the way they want to do it, or a renter may want to do something better, and the landowner isn't aware. And that's time intensive to do that, to reach out to the people who aren't the family farmers who live on the land. And women are the key here. Women own tens of percents of Minnesota farmland and aren't there. So that's an example that I have. But we're also still doing the work, I think, as they say. There are components to equity where we haven't really thought it through. And we had a great presentation from a state employee who is the owner of his family's farm in Alabama. He's an African-American, and he gave us a great presentation about the Pigford civil rights case, where the USDA, over many decades, particularly in the South, denied financial and technical assistance to African-American farmers, which is why there are fewer African-American farmers. That led to a massive civil rights case, and he gave a presentation to us. And when I said we're not really sure how we need to look at things, we're not really sure how many African-American farmers never got technical assistance in Minnesota over many decades. I mean, it's just that deep. We're going back decades sometimes to understand those disparities. I know that's kind of a vague answer, Representative Finke, but a lot of us are trying to do the work and open our minds to looking at this in new ways, and so we're still finding new things.
Representative Finke.
Yeah, I appreciate that answer, and I believe it is our responsibility to find those problems and reach those people and fix those problems. We shouldn't be waiting for people in underserved communities to realize that they have issues in their septic systems, right? It's up to us to fix those problems. So I'm glad to hear that you're continuing to find new ones, and I would encourage you to make sure you're requesting the funds necessary to take care of those problems, because that's our responsibility.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Finke.
Can you back up a second to the St. Paul program that's being rolled out, and then why is that a good thing? What's achieved by, and then who's getting the new toilets and all that?
Sure.
My community did it, and it seemed like it was quite successful and popular, and I'm hoping the same in St. Paul. Does Minneapolis do anything of that sort?
Mr. Chair, yesterday I said to the Met Council, when they provided me that excellent information on St. Paul, that someone would ask me if Minneapolis is also asking, and they are. I do not believe the city was ready to submit a proposal yet, but they're thinking about it. So, Mr. Chair, all public water systems leak. Older systems can leak 15% or more, just with old pipes leaking. In my city in Shoreview, after they stuck cameras in and figured out where the leaks were and sealed them, that leakage number has gone down, and that's just increased the efficiency of the system, and people aren't paying for water that isn't being used. So the same idea is being used in St. Paul. But the water efficiency program that the Met Council is carrying out with the Clean Water Fund is designed to reduce water demand in the metro area. It had a heavy focus on groundwater, which is why a lot of suburban communities that waste a lot of water with sprinkling applied, but now we have a city like St. Paul, which uses Mississippi River water, being able to access this funds, and they're particularly focusing on households that otherwise couldn't afford to replace a very water-intensive fixture like a toilet. And that's going to be focused on multi-unit housing. I do have a handout that I could give Mr. Mulzon through a page if you want to have it for the record on what they're doing in St. Paul.
Thank you, Director Gardner. We'll get that later.
And Mr. Chair, I understand the leak detection would help focus on the water supply for 15,000 to 20,000 accounts out of 95,000 accounts in the city of St. Paul.
Thank you, Director. That sounds like a big percentage. So that's good. Any other questions at this point? I'm going to throw one out. I am lucky enough to serve on capital investment, and I had an opportunity, the PFA came in, and so I mentioned to them about the toilets outstate, and or some of these low flush options, and they said their need is different out there, so that's interesting to me. But it makes sense that they do a lot of ground or surface kind of a water treatment and have other systems that they do outstate. But I have a question in regards to the federal money. Does the federal money, is that going to impact, are you taking that into consideration as a council as you go forward? Because there's bucket loads of federal money that are coming down the line. And so will some of our money that we do with this, will they be used for matching, or are you trying to work with PFA and other areas to maximize the federal money that Minnesota can get?
Mr. Chair, that's a great question. So we do leverage some federal money anyway, but much of the new money coming from the infrastructure bill is for stuff that isn't really within our lane as much. So a lot of the gray infrastructure that the Public Facilities Authority might be dealing with is not something that bonding money would be the thing that would probably leverage more. I'll phone a friend if anyone thinks they have a different answer, but we at least have been paying attention. There's some money that came in the infrastructure bill for the hypoxia area in the Gulf of Mexico, the dead zone. So we got a couple million out of that, but I don't think there was any match requirement. I have some examples in this slide where we've leveraged federal money because of some seed funding from the Clean Water Fund, but that was on some longer-term projects like the Duluth Superior Harbor, the St. Louis River estuary, where they're pretty darn close to completing all the projects they need to get off the area of concern list and turn that into a great recreational asset. There's a lot of federal money for farmers for conservation practices that has been leveraged, like the Ag Water Quality Certification Program. It's been $6 million every 2 years, and so we've gotten at least $6 million in funding from the feds that goes direct to farmers as a result, and we use the Clean Water Fund as the match. We've also chipped in money for the CREP program to help leverage the $2 for every dollar that we get in the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program. And then one project we had a look at about a year and a half ago was in the resort communities around Voyageurs National Park. You've got a lot of communities that have really challenging geology where the bedrock is really close to the surface and a traditional sewage system doesn't work very well. So a lot of bacteria was going into the lakes in Voyageurs National Park. And so the communities there worked with us. We've given some seed money to help leverage state and local dollars and federal dollars to help do really complex projects. So we were the first dollar on the table in some cases. But I wouldn't say that we're not as focused on the new federal money in the last 2 years as some other agencies are through their programs.
Go ahead, Director Gardner.
And Mr. Chair, I would just note, you know, for every dollar in Clean Water Fund expenditures, we now can document more than $1.09 that's leveraged from other sources. And that number is probably higher because we don't include landowner contributions when they chip in their own money for a match.
Go ahead, Representative Backer.
Yeah, just more. This is not for the director because him and I have had this conversation, more for the colleagues from the metro area. Out in greater Minnesota, you know, for that clean water, improving the water treatment plants is probably the most important, because that's when you have, like in the district that I serve, I think I have 30 communities now. My old district was 42. A lot of these smaller communities don't have that tax capacity to approve. Like the city of Browns Valley was 1980, 81 was the last time that we did that. So there can be a lot of improvements with clean water and making sure with good science instead of some of the stuff that's coming down that we don't know, parts per billion really have an effect. But leaky pipes are not as important for us as those clean treatment plants for clean water. So. And how we handle our waste. So that's all, just informational purpose. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative.
And Mr. Chair, I didn't emphasize it, but roughly 13-14% of the Clean Water Fund is used for the Public Facilities Authority for the Point Source Implementation Grant Program, which helps existing plants improve things just enough to make sure that they're hitting their effluent targets. So. And I believe the Clean Water Fund was the first source of funding for that, and then Governor Dayton really pushed for bonding for that as well. So it does come from the bonding bill as well. I made a list of some of those projects.
I believe both are needed. The need is really great, especially in greater Minnesota, for the PFA work. And I think it's good that Dayton added on top of it. And so go ahead. Yep. Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, as I represent northeastern Minnesota, the whole lot of area you're talking about, I was the mayor of Ely. We've been beneficial of every program that you've mentioned. You know, that as a mayor, I remember using all of these programs. One helps the other, another bonding. You know, it's really when you find an administrator that knows how to walk through this field and use them properly, we can get a whole lot done. And like you say, one doesn't fund the whole thing. Funds a little here and then a little here. And I really applaud this program, what we're trying to do. And I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up your involvement with the Voyageurs National Park. It's very important that we have that involvement. It's a project that I hope we can, you know, finally get through, maybe this year, maybe next year. But it's a it's going to help the whole watershed. So thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Scraba.
And Mr. Chair,
Director Gardner.
Representative Scraba and I have met yet, but I did produce a fact sheet for Senator Hochschild, who has your district in another, the biggest. I think Representative Dill said it's the size of Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island combined, or something like that.
Vermont.
But I ended up making a list of all the municipalities that received some aid in that part of the state, and it is really substantial, including some grants for businesses in the area. So there are a lot of what we call transient source water protection grants made to help small businesses that are in a remote area that have a tax base that drilled a deeper well. Or had some other infrastructure like that, and the number was astronomically high. So those are little bitty grants that go a long way.
Director Gardner, I see we're kind of looks like you're towards the end and maybe transitioning to the recommendations. I was wondering, you've got about eight main groups that get funding, and I was wondering if you could just do a quick. We've never really done this at the committee level. It'd be nice if each of them came down and just briefly said what they do, like what ag does, how they work with you, maybe how they work with Lassard Sams, you know, how you all interact. I mean, how many jobs, what you're doing to get young people involved, and those sort of things. I mean, you can address some of that, but mostly if we can put a face with each group. So
they're all here, Mr. Chair. So
yes, I think it'd be really good for our committee members, given that we have so many, and even some of us that have been around for a while, if they could just, you know, you can do it in the order you want. I get to see Mr. Freeman quite a bit with capital investment, but you know, I think it'd be good for members to put a face to each kind of entity, and if they could just briefly just describe how their, you know, what their work is, just quickly.
Sure. Is it all right if I just give you the top-level highlights for the recommendations that are coming your way?
Why don't you just wait?
Okay, I will. Well, why don't I...
go ahead. That was your... If you feel it's better to do the other at the end. Go ahead.
Oh, sure. Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to mention the things that are new and improved that are coming to you in this set of recommendations. First, we're putting in several tens of millions of dollars more to the Board of Water and Soil Resources for projects, I call them shovel-ready projects, that are identified in the plans. More plans get done, so there are more dollars appropriated. The Forever Green program at the Department of Ag and the University of Minnesota will get a 50% increase. Let Ag describe that. More grants to cities to reduce chloride, particularly from inefficient water softeners, which is a big problem. The PCA would get more money for low-income grants for septic system replacement. The DNR and Bowser will have more money to help store water on the land, on both public and private land, which helps water quality. And then the Department of Ag and Bowser will also be engaging more landowners on how to employ soil health techniques, which give you multiple benefits for water quality, flood mitigation, carbon sequestration, risk reduction, and the like. But we're also going to be putting some money, and I think the Metro members would be interested to hear, in increasing our capacity to assess threats. We do worry about, you know, staying on track with our 25-year plan, but also new ideas are thrown at us all the time where we're trying to address new things. So PFAS is obviously a big one. We're increasing our investment in PFAS so we can have consistent data on monitoring and assessment. The free well testing I mentioned, culvert cost share for the DNR. There's some climate resilience interaction here. I never really thought I'd be talking about culverts and water quality, but a poorly designed culvert can hinder our efforts. Freshwater mussel restorations would get some turbocharging. They actually can help filter water of nutrients. Oops, this is an old one, the Great Lakes money. I'll scratch that one. But one thing that we've been asked for quite a bit in the metro is doing something that we've paid for in Lake Superior, and that is have a statewide beach health portal. So if you want to know whether your local lake is open and not closed for reasons of too much bacteria or something, eventually there'll be a one-stop shop where you can look this up. And I mention this in particular because Iowa and Wisconsin have this. And I know that, Mr. Chair, that will make many people indignant. So I mention that. Why don't I call down the agencies here one at a time, if that works? Is Bowser available to chime in?
Maybe that category receives, and then roughly how many, and then just kind of a brief description, if they can, of the work.
And the pie chart, this actually had our February forecast numbers, so they're off by a point or two, but generally you get the idea.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself and go ahead when you're ready, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andrea Fish. I am Assistant Director for Strategy and Operations at the Board of Water and Soil Resources. I'm fairly new to the board. I just started in November. The board works directly with local governments and landowners primarily in order to preserve, protect, and enhance our state's natural resources. In the name, water and soil are big ones, so a lot of farmers. And a lot of our budget is actually passed through so that we do grant making to landowners and, again, local governments, watershed districts, and soil and water conservation districts to achieve our mutual aims.
Thank you. Welcome aboard.
I've got the Department of Ag. Got a couple of books.
I think we need you back. I'm sorry, Ms. Fish. Or Paul, can you answer? We have a question from Representative Scrob. I don't think we heard numbers.
Yes, I was just curious. I thought we were going to find out how much each one was awarded or asking for. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Scrava.
And Mr. Chair, I will report back to Mr. Carter.
Mr. Chair, just going down the list, Bowser, out of a $315,300,000 that's going to be in the recommendations for fiscal 2024-25, Bowser would receive 50%, which is $157,427,000.
How many employees? Can that kind of give an idea?
Mr. Chair, I don't have an exact number. I believe it is under 150. Again, most of this funding is passed through that goes then directly to landowners through local governments.
Thank you.
We've got Mr. Stoddard and Mr. Redland from the Department of Ag, which would receive 12% of the funding at $38,580,000.
Please introduce yourself and go ahead when you're ready. I'm sorry to folks, but I think it's really good for the committee members to have a sense of who's getting the funds, how much, and to have this interaction. We've actually not really done it quite this way, but I think it's good for all of us and for you too.
Sure.
Go ahead and please introduce yourself.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dan Stoddard. I am Assistant Director for Environmental Programs for Pesticides and Fertilizers at the Department of Ag.
Good morning. My name is Brad Jordahl-Redland. I'm a program manager for the Minnesota Ag Water Quality Certification Program and the Soil Health Financial Assistance Program at the Department of Ag.
So the Department of Ag is the lead agency in the state of Minnesota responsible for pesticides and fertilizers, and we interact with the ag community in promoting practices, education. We also interact very much with the University of Minnesota on different research projects. Promoting BMPs, best management practices for agriculture, and vegetative cover like Forever Green. So I can give you a quick snapshot of the activities that we have and the funding amount. I don't have the number of FTEs with me, sorry. but quickly. So we get funding to monitor pesticides in surface water and groundwater. It's $700,000 per biennium. And what we do is we have a statewide monitoring network for pesticides in surface water and groundwater, which has been in place for 20 to 30 years. We test private wells for pesticides. That's about $1 million per biennium. And what we did was we had a monitoring program for nitrate in vulnerable areas across the state. And the legislature asked us to also add pesticides to that, so we did. We do a very rigorous scan of pesticides at no cost, targeting vulnerable areas. But we have found a particular pesticide, cyanazine, which hasn't been used for 20 years in groundwater, and we are continuing to sample just for those wells which are of greatest concern for this particular pesticide and some other chemicals. We have an Ag BMP loan program, which provides very low-cost loans through local governments. The funding is $6.5 million per biennium. Almost 100% of that is passed through. It's an extremely efficient program, and it is a loan program which is controlled by local governments. It's a very popular, effective program. I'll go through and then you can do yours. We have a technical assistance program, which provides...
Sir, can you just explain the acronyms like the...
Oh, I'm very sorry. So the agricultural best management practices. So
thank
we
you.
Use the term BMP very commonly. I apologize for that. So it's kind of in my blood. But the Ag BMP loan program provides loans for a great range of practices, basically anything that could improve water quality or respond to poor water quality, including replacement of wells, equipment, a whole variety of activities are covered under this program. We also have a technical assistance program. The funding is $3 million per biennium. And through that, we have demonstration projects, and we provide technical assistance to the ag community across the state to help educate and promote on agricultural best management practices for a variety of different activities. So we have demonstration projects across the state to promote these practices, which can improve groundwater quality and surface water quality. We are also asking for $3 million of the biennium to expand an existing ag weather station network. So we already have weather stations in northwest Minnesota and some other areas. These stations, we want to do is install a grid on a 20-mile or a 20-mile grid where there will be a weather station within 20 miles everywhere across the state. And this information is extremely important in helping the ag community make decisions on how to apply chemicals and manage manure and other ag practices to minimize environmental impacts. We fund a position at the University of Minnesota, an irrigation water quality expert who develops, again, best management practices for irrigation, does a lot of education on irrigation practices. That's $300,000 per biennium. We have $600,000 per biennium to address nitrate in groundwater. This is one of the biggest contaminants around the state. So MDA funded a program to sample private wells across the state in vulnerable areas. And in 344 vulnerable townships across the state, over 10% of the wells, 9% of the wells across the state exceed the drinking water standard in these vulnerable areas, and in some cases, it's a very high percentage, 20 or 30%. So we are targeting practices, working with the ag community to improve nitrate from agricultural sources in these vulnerable areas. We have a research inventory database, which just, it's an easy access to existing research data online. That's $80,000 per biennium. $6 million is going to the Forever Green program at the University of Minnesota. That's 100% pass-through, and they are doing research, cutting-edge research, to evaluate new vegetative crops and cropping systems that can improve groundwater quality. And then we have $1.5 million, which is proposed to go to the University of Minnesota for evaluating manure crediting. So a lot of the current information provided by the university is fairly old. Some of it's 20 years old. What we need to do is to provide more accurate information to ensure there's proper crediting for manure. Want to do your two?
Sure.
Thank you. Mr. Redman?
Yes, I will speak to two primary programs I oversee, the Minnesota Agriculture Water Quality Certification Program. That is a $7 million ask for this upcoming biennium. This program we hope folks are familiar with, but we're always happy to talk about. We are 945,000 acres certified right now. The entire appropriation received over the entire history of this program divided by acres certified is $24 per acre. So that is a price that is competitive in any federal farm or state conservation program you'll find anywhere, and we're very proud of the efficiency of this program and the effect that it's having. For farmers who egg-centric and the Farm Business Management Program at Minnesota State Colleges show that certified farms are 36% higher net income than non-certified farms, and so we are proud of the service that we're providing them economically and environmentally. I would speak to the proposal for a conservation equipment grant. This would be extending a pilot that we have just launched just over a week ago for soil health equipment grants. This is to offset the demand out there for specialized equipment to conduct particularly effective for production and for environmental outcomes soil health activities, no-till drills or cover crop seeders or whatever it is, strip-till machines, those type of things that, as everything in agriculture, has a high upfront cost for entry-level bringing that into an operation. So we're proud of having this new program running. We're excited to see more money. We have $475,000 in the pilot, and I can tell you in a week and a half, we already have asked over $500,000 in proposals for that. So we're showing that the demand is out in just 1 week's time. So we're eager to pursue more opportunity to provide more of those funds that growers are clearly seeking. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you both. I think I noticed a presentation the other day on new members on Almanac, and I think Jacob, the new Republican state rep from Southern Minnesota, I think he's a certified farm. I think I've got a picture of his.
It's a pretty sign.
It's a pretty sign. Was that, it's almost 1 million acres, is that what you?
Correct, yes.
Wow, yeah. That's amazing. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi, please introduce yourself. Go ahead when you're ready, please.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Dana Vanderbosch, and I am the Assistant Commissioner for Water Policy and Agriculture at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. The MPCA has received clean water funding since the inception of the fund, and the primary purposes that the primary places where we use this funding is on a comprehensive water monitoring program. It's a water monitoring program for rivers and streams. We have networks set up in all 80 of the watersheds here in Minnesota, and we conduct chemistry and biological monitoring of these rivers and lakes and streams. That information is then assessed to determine if waters are either polluted or if they're in a state of health. And for all of the waters that are polluted, then we do an in-depth study to determine the sources and the magnitude of the pollution and what needs to be reduced in order to return that resource back into a state of health. So the water monitoring data, the assessment decisions, and the in-depth studies then move to another branch of the agency, our watershed division, where they also do comprehensive watershed models to determine kind of the flow of pollutants throughout each of the major watersheds. And all of this science then is kind of wrapped together in a document called a Watershed Restoration and Protection Strategy. It's called a RAPS. And so every major watershed has a RAPS, and it's essentially a compilation and interpretation of all of the science that's handed off to the local unit of government, and then the local unit of governments will then use that information for their planning and their implementation work. So that's a very large part of what the MPCA does, and a lot of these responsibilities are actually codified in the Clean Water Act, the Federal Clean Water Act. We also have programs that are aimed at providing support to water permittees. We have hundreds and hundreds of permittees across the state, wastewater treatment facilities and municipalities that have stormwater permits, and clean water funding provides critical support in the form of grant programs and technical assistance to those permittees. And then lastly, we do ask for $1.5 million every biennium for St. Louis River Area of Concern. We use that funding to complete projects and to leverage federal funds. I think I've hit on most of my programs. Let me just take a peek. Oh, our SSTS program. So we have a septic system program that Paul referred to. We provide not only base grants to all of the counties so that they can operate their septic system or SSTS programs, but then we also have grant programs where counties can apply for grants and then they use those grants to fund septic system replacements or repairs for families with low income that otherwise wouldn't be able to make those repairs to their septic systems. So that's been a critical program that counties have tapped into for many years. And we actually provide a legislative report every 2 years, and I think we just delivered our last legislative report a couple of weeks ago. So I could get that for the committee if you haven't seen it.
Thank you. That'd be nice.
Okay.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. Just a quick question. So you've,
Sure. You're
monitoring the plastics and the PFAS, and you feel like you have enough funds to do some of that work moving forward?
Yeah, thanks
for you were to fund at the level coming up.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Mr. Chair. I actually forgot one of my programs. We do groundwater modeling or groundwater monitoring as well. We do some groundwater monitoring, the Department of Ag does and the Department of Health does. We collaborate together to execute a comprehensive groundwater monitoring system across the state. But in answer to your question, Mr. Chair, we are asking for some additional funding for our river and lake monitoring program so that we can start incorporate some PFAS sampling in our network so that it moves from being an emerging chemical, as we've been talking about it, where we're monitoring it through projects and special research, and instead we're trying to incorporate and embed some of that monitoring into our everyday kind of, you know, routine monitoring networks. So we would say the investment that we're asking for will get us started. It will allow us to get our networks kind of settled and up and running, and I think we'll have to see what the next data needs are. Whenever we monitor, the first thing we want to make sure is that we understand what kind of data we need and that we're designing a system that will yield the data that we need. And so as we start up, we believe that this will be a good launch, but it's possible we may need additional funds to ramp up in future years.
Thank you. Representative Hurt. No, if it's appropriate to testify, please go ahead.
Thank you.
Representative Hurt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my apologies. I was presenting a bill in another committee, so I missed the entire presentation. But I just wanted to ask about the monitoring. I know that a couple of years ago there was PFAS found in the water that runs through Representative Zhang's district that flows into Pig's Eye. And I was just wondering if identifying that PFAS was part of some of this programming and monitoring that you did, or was it, because I guess my concern is that I think sometimes we sort of overlook, we only have so many resources, and we sort of overlook certain places in which we might be doing monitoring. And I often find that sometimes some of our communities, especially from low-income or immigrant communities, are actually fishing and living off of some of the vegetation they're finding around these water sources that have chemicals in them that have long-term effects on them. And I guess I just wanted to understand, like, in your monitoring process and the funding that you get, how you sort of decide, where that happens, and then also, just curious if you all were the agency that found the PFAS in that, or was that brought to your attention from another entity?
Assistant Commissioner, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Herr. The particular monitoring effort that you are talking about was not a part of our routine monitoring program. It must have been a part of a special study that was done. That would be my guess. I'm not really very familiar with it, but you raise a really important point that for a lot of our monitoring programs, what we're trying to gather is kind of what we would call the background or the ambient condition, the basic background condition of our lakes and our rivers. But, you know, as I pointed out, once we know that there's a polluted water, we call it an impairment, meaning that the water quality is not meeting water quality standards, then we focus special intensive studies to figure out the source of the pollution and how to address the problem. And so hopefully these PFAS monies that we're proposing would get us going on doing that type of routine work that you're talking about. And the other point that you're making is, you know, where do you position or site monitoring locations to make sure that you're addressing community needs. I mean, that is a critical part of our monitoring work. And we spend, before we go into a given watershed, we spend time in the previous year sitting down with the local water authorities and planning the monitoring, and they help us decide where we should place monitoring locations to make sure that we're hitting places that are of importance to the community. So that's kind of baked into our process.
Thank you. Representative Hurd. We have a few more presenters, so and I know Representative Becker.
Go ahead. I just have a quick. Chair. How many FTEs are funded at your department through the Clean Water Fund? Thank you.
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Becker, I think it's 93. I mean, it's between 90 and 95.
Thank you. Thank you for coming today and coming down. Sounds like the DNR better get some signs over on the east side to make sure those fish are safe.
I was distracted, Mr. Chair.
Oh, okay. Please introduce yourself.
Jason Meckel, Department of Natural Resources. I manage a section, Inventory Monitoring Analysis in the Division of Ecological and Water Resources. Do you have the dollar? What did we get? I can't remember these off the top of my head. So this year's proposal is for $25 million to go to the DNR, 8% of the total. Most of the DNR's role with the Clean Water Fund is to collect and analyze data. And most of that's around the quantity of things, and there's a few exceptions that I'll talk about that. So we've built out the best in the nation stream flow monitoring network. That's essential to the pollutant loads work that the PCA does, so we can figure out the impairments. We also have one of the best in the nation groundwater monitoring networks, in large part thanks to the Clean Water Council and the Clean Water Fund and the legislature supporting that work. And I just want to mention, you had asked about in the metro area, one of the very early investments made from the Clean Water Fund was $5 million to build a monitoring network here in the Twin Cities to make sure that we know what's happening with our groundwater, which is a primary supply for many of our suburban communities. So that network is built out, but we use the Clean Water Fund to continue to be able to maintain it and monitor it and publish that data through our website. So mostly we're about collecting data, analyzing that data, and providing it to all the reportings and the plans and everything that you've heard about today. And then what we do is our staff specialize in a lot of stream ecosystems and providing technical assistance on how to repair and restore stream ecosystems that have been affected by increased runoff, by pollutant loads, by past ditching, that sort of thing, and some of the projects that you've seen over the years, this committee has seen over the years. Our staff provide that technical assistance. The other thing that I would say is that many of the projects that get built are actually funded by the Lasard Outdoor Heritage Council, but the project idea and some of the technical assistance might have been supported with work done by the Clean Water Fund. Okay, so these things kind of all knit together. The WAFL, yes. Mr. Gardner asked me to mention the WAFL. WAFL is another acronym, maybe one of the fun ones to use your, yeah. It's a watershed health assessment framework for lakes. We just released this. It's available on our website. Anybody can go in. You can find a lake, and it can give you a health score for that lake. You look at water quality, water clarity. You can look at fish. You can look at all these things and understand what might be affecting the health of that lake by looking at its watershed. Just released in the last week, the WAF, the Watershed Health Assessment Framework, has been around for the Clean Water Fund started it. It's been around for 10 years, and now we've added the lakes, all the lakes information to it. It's a big advancement. Mr. Gardner mentioned a couple of the new programs that you'll hear about as we go through the session this year, culverts, and I just want to speak to that a little bit. real quick. Many of our culverts no longer are functioning. They're undersized for the climate that we now have, and we're getting about 4 inches more rainfall annually than we used to. These culverts are failing. They also have interrupted the passage of fish, so these fish species can't move through them. That interrupts the health of the system. In some cases, all we would need to do is replace 3 or 4 or 5 culverts in a watershed, and that may be able to get us to an unimpaired, you know, take it off the listing because the biology can do its thing now, right? So it's simple things like that. What we want to do is provide some incentive to communities, to local governments, to be able to replace those culverts and do it in a way that's ecologically, water quality, sustainable, climate, all of that. And then the other thing, our sort of favorite new program is to accelerate the restoration of freshwater mussels in the state. The mussel conversation in the state of Minnesota has been dominated by zebra mussels, and it's invasive. It's not good for our waterways. Our freshwater clams are. And if you don't know about them, learn about them. Our website's got some great information. They are nature's water filters. They don't require electricity to filter water. They do it biologically, and they're critical to our ecosystems. And we've figured out how to grow them in a lab, and we figured out how to restore them in river systems. And now what we're going to do is expand that capacity and take it to full-scale production.
Thank you very much. You're welcome. It's really amazing the scope of all the things we're able to do with these legacy funds. Go ahead, bring down. And I really liked hearing that, you know, so many of these funds are intertwined. And then I know a lot of the Lessard work is done on top of what you're doing, so that's important. Go ahead, please, introduce yourself. I'm sorry we don't have much time, but you can just kind of give us a snapshot. That'd be great.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Tani Eschenauer. I'm the manager of the Water Policy Center at the Minnesota Department of Health, and I'll just tell you quickly that our vision in support of our agency mission is that drinking water is safe for everyone, everywhere in Minnesota, that drinking water is an essential condition for healthy communities and a healthy economy, and we recognize that. And in the amendment, it provides for protection of our drinking water sources, both the groundwater that you've heard a lot about today, but also we have systems that rely on surface water. That the public systems are about 1,000 that serve communities, people where they live, and then another 6,000 that serve people where they work and play. And then we have about 500,000 private wells in the state that we have a record for, but there are probably double that which were built before we had a well code. Our Clean Water Fund initiatives revolve around drinking water for the most part, although the beach porthole that the director mentioned is a new one. We have the Contaminants of Emerging Concern drinking water program. We are asking for a sizable increase in that because of the threat of PFAS and the amount of capacity that we will need in our laboratory and also doing health risk assessment for that suite of chemicals. Our source water protection program allows us to both accelerate the planning that we're doing with community systems across the state, as well as provide really modest grants. $10,000 is the max to implement those plans. A counterpart to the watershed restoration and protection strategies that you've heard about is one that's lesser known but still important, and that's our groundwater restoration and protection strategies. We don't go out and get new data. We take existing data and we put it into a format so that it can be fed into the local comprehensive watershed planning that all the 80 watersheds are doing. Our private well initiative, it was looking at the 1.2 million Minnesotans who rely on a private well. Where a well is constructed, how it's constructed, is regulated by the well code. But after that, the quality of that water depends on the initiative of that private well owner. And we have concerns about the Minnesotans who may be drinking unsafe levels of things like arsenic, nitrate was already mentioned, but also PFAS and potentially things like manganese and lead and bacteria. We have an initiative to plan for the future of drinking water. This will be a statewide drinking water plan, the first of its kind. It will tell us what we need to do between 2024 and 2034, the sunset of the amendment, to ensure that everyone has safe drinking water in the state. That is also the initiative that provided for the lead report that the director mentioned earlier. And then finally, Director Gardner already mentioned our beach porthole. We're very excited about that. We get thousands of calls. Is my beach, my lake safe to swim at? And at this point, we can't answer that question because we don't have a centralized place to record that data. So thank you very much.
Thank you for coming down. And I know all of you are available for questions, I'm sure, from members if we have them in the future. Mr. Freeman, please introduce yourself. And
Mr. Chair and members, good morning. My name is Jeff Freeman. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Facilities Authority, We are the state agency that provides financing to cities for municipal wastewater and drinking water infrastructure projects. The Clean Water Fund dollars that we get, which the governor's recommendation, it's about 5%, $16.7 million, is targeted to a narrow slice of the overall work that we do. The majority of that money goes to the Point Source Implementation Grant Program, which is specifically focused on helping cities upgrade treatment facilities to meet more stringent discharge limits in order to improve water quality of a particular stream or receiving water. So a lot of times those are treatment improvements to reduce discharge of phosphorus, meet more stringent limits for phosphorus. There's other pollutants as well. Also, some of that money goes for stormwater treatment projects in, as well. And then a small amount of the Clean Water Fund dollars go to, Mr. Gardner mentioned, our small community program, which is the small unsewered, undersewered, very small kind of crossroad communities where septic systems are failing, non-complying, and there's just not enough space or right soil conditions to replace individual systems. And so that money goes to help those cities figure out other wastewater solutions. Those are the majority of the work we do is outside of the Clean Water Fund, helping cities replace aging infrastructure, our revolving loan funds, as well as the WIF grants for cities that otherwise would not be able to meet those high priority projects, and it would be unaffordable for them to do so. So a large portion is outside the Clean Water Fund. A narrow part is what we receive Clean Water Fund dollars to do.
Thank you. Mr. Freeman, I know you're available for questions, and I know you had a great presentation with Chair Lee's committee, and I know you're doing good work for the state. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is the Met Council? Oh, wow. Okay. Come on down quick. You have like 30 seconds.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Please
committee members.
Yourself and go ahead.
Yep. Sam Paskey, Assistant General Manager in the Environmental Services Division of the Met Council. I'll limit my comments to that role. The Met Council is funded with two programs, a water efficiency grant program. 100% of those funds go to local government and through to the end users of the local government water supplies, and matching funds are provided. So there's a more than one-to-one ratio there. That program is funded under $1 million a year, and it's been growing. It's very popular and very effective. The other program that the Clean Water Fund supports for the Met Council is our water sustainability program, which is, since the Met Council is neither a regulator nor a water supplier, that program supports collaboration at the local level, local government coming together to manage and sustain a limited resource, the water sources that we use for water supplies. And that work is guided by the Metropolitan Area Water Supply Advisory Committee, or MASAC, which was created by the legislature to coordinate water supply work amongst agencies and local government in the metro area. And that program is funded at a little over $1 million a year. So fairly small but very effective spending.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming down. I know that you didn't plan that, and I very much appreciate it. Director Gardner, I know we're going to have you back. Appreciate your coming today, and I hope you're available, and I know you will be for all the members, and thank you. I think this area is so important because I really, you know, the fundamental to the legacy passing in my mind is the little girl on the dock, I think, on the TV ads, and, you know, being true to that, and we've got to really make a strong effort to make sure our water is more swimmable, drinkable, and fishable. And so you have a big task. I know it's not something you do overnight, and but we expect a lot too, and we're blessed by the state to value these important works. So thank you all for the discussion today, and with that, we are adjourned.